So the Buddha, when he was old, said that his body felt like that of a old cart held together by ropes and string and driftwood and discarded wood. Breaking my own advice.
Yeah, I was watching that.
And he compared this to the first arrow, which he says is inevitable. In life, there are things that we get shot with, no matter how skillful we are. But then on top of that, we then go on to shoot ourselves with second arrows. These are the way we react. We take things personally when they're universal. We try to avoid what can't be avoided. We try to hold on to and control what cannot be contained or controlled. It's basically, in a nutshell, another way of putting the first and second noble truths. The first noble truth could be summarized as shit happens. We grow old. We become sick. We get separated from things and people we love, and we get stuck with things and people we definitely don't love. We get insulted at times for things that are no fault of ours, and we get abandoned and rejected and put upon, and all kinds of other difficult challenges will arise. And this is what we've signed up for with a human birth. You may not remember signing up for it. It's in fact a turn of phrase that I realize. It's a Buddhist-y thing to say, but when you investigate it closely, you know. Anyway. So, the second noble truth, though, is that we make it all so unbearable by the way we react to these givens. So for an example, I'll give a couple. The symptoms of panic attack are actually universal across the population. But only a very few people get panic attack disorder or syndrome. What's the difference? Most people would assume it's the intensity or amount, but actually it's not. The people who get panic attack disorders are the ones who react to the panic symptoms while they're occurring with great fear and anxiety and a trying to avoid and then create, when they're not having the symptoms, even more fear of them arising and thus create a trauma around the basic symptoms of physical fear. In other words, everybody at certain times experiences the racing heartbeats, the hypertension, the hair standing on end, the sweating, the nervousness, and even the racing mind and a little bit of nausea. But certain people turn it into a disorder. Another example is everybody experiences social anxiety. We all, at certain points in our life, worry what other people are thinking about us, how we're being viewed, and we feel an arise of discomfort around that. But only certain people develop social anxiety around the symptoms. Again, it's not the fundamental experience that causes the great suffering. It's the way we react to those inevitably human events. Everybody who goes generally into war zones experiences extremely traumatic events, but there are many people who return without PTSD, and many, many who do return with it. There are, in the way we react to life, that's the way we add the bulk of our suffering. It's not in the first arrow, it's in the second arrow. So, the truth is that we're all set up to shoot ourselves with second arrows. The brain is set up to survive, not to be happy. That's what the brain is, a survival tool, like every other part of the human body. It was set there to keep us alive another day so that we could procreate. That's the hard truth that Darwin presented. And if any of you happen to be creationists, just work with me. So, trying to envision the horror that a creationist would feel. So, we have parts of the brain in largely tucked into the basal ganglia area that are set up to record things that we find frightening or opportunistic. And this part of the brain is working from the moment we're born, and it doesn't let go of things that it finds scary. So, what you found scary as a 4-year-old will still frighten you as a 44-year-old unless you somehow manage to re-tag those sensations and associations as not harmful or threatening. This is why so much of our experience is based on avoidance, because whenever we tag something unconsciously as challenging, difficult, uncomfortable, threatening, unless we subsequently re-tag it as something we can survive easily, the amygdala maintains that and triggers us and tells us, fuck, I didn't like this the last time, and it makes the entire body and breath tight, and we go into panic. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about, given that so much of life is uncontrollable, not only externals and other people and careers and money, it's all beyond our control, but also our underlying physical states and our emotions and moods, so much of those are not controllable either. How is it that we can relate to our experience so that we don't shoot ourselves with that second arrow, so that we learn to experience the difficult emotions and physical states and the bad news that comes to us externally without turning it into something that causes even more stress and suffering? This boils down to two things that the Buddha talked about quite frequently, which is attention and perception. Attention is how we focus our awareness on things and what kind of awareness we bring to things. And perception is the way we label our experience and file it away. So in any given moment, we're focusing the mind and we're adding little labels. We're also carrying intentions, and that's important too, but that would make the talk huge. So I might summarize a little of that, but I'm going to focus on attention and perception, because these are areas that we're often unaware of that can create so much suffering and discomfort in life. Generally, the kind of attention that we are programmed with is a survival attention, which means it's biased towards areas of cognition that it thinks threats and opportunities will occur in. Most of us will experience the dire threats to our survival externally. And so we have an external bias. We also will find that most of the food that we eat and the clothing that keeps us warm, they happen to be external too. So we tend to be externally focused and very unaware of the internal experience that we're carrying around. We also tend to focus on the bad news in life, the threats, and the opportunities, and we lose track very easily of all the other things that are available. We fail to embrace our life as it is, and we tend to flood our awareness towards what's missing or what's threatening. And we don't see all that we've fully developed to keep ourselves, what's available to keep ourselves secure and happy. So the first kind of attention is that's predisposed to vigilance externally. We move through our lives, we're busy, we're worrying what people think about us, you know, any bit of information in a relationship that's new or in work or in families, we fixate on, and we're unaware of the amount of stress that's being carried. And very often the amygdala, when it's associated something as being dangerous or bad or possibly really, really good, it's communicating, and unfortunately doesn't talk to us via language. It's the oldest and it's one of the stupidest parts of the brain. It's pre-verbal. It's in the basal ganglia, and the only way it knows how to communicate to us is via the body. It has no direct link at all to the prefrontal cortex, where thoughts and where we maintain consciousness. So the only way our key survival mechanisms talk to us is through the body and the breath, and also occasionally just by making the mind jumpy, but it never talks to us by thoughts. So when we see something that we've in the past associated with being dangerous or being really good, even if it's a false association or a cultural bias, we start to get tense or excited. And the more externally aware we are, we don't see how these very old associations are unconsciously pushing us around. And when we're unconscious of them, we can't relax them. So, for example, suppose you've been told as a child that Eskimos are dangerous people. And you've been shown TV shows where the bad guy is the Eskimos. I'm trying to show how ridiculous racism and all this is. So, so your Eskimos are bad, and you're walking down the street. And a horde of Eskimos is coming towards you. And you may be an enlightened person. I don't mind Eskimos. They're terrific. Some of my best friends. Are indigenous Alaskans. But the body will get tense. You'll start to panic. And so we will start getting nervous and fidgety and sometimes even find ourselves becoming protective. Women might clutch their handbags. Men might feel for their wallets. And so, unless we breathe and relax and override and re-tag, this situation is not threatening, and take it in, the more we add stress, the more we tag Eskimos as dangerous, and we keep the cycle going. We keep ourselves locked in to this old and ridiculous cultural bias that we've picked up as children. And this happens across so many domains of life. We carry around perceptions that have been lodged unconsciously that create stress, that pushes us around, adds more stress, re-tags things as dangerous, and we fall into this feedback loop of avoidance. So the only way to de-tag is to become aware of what's going on in the breath, in the body, and to remind ourselves first, go down, relax the breath, deepen the out-breath, make it full and long, relax the belly, soften the belly, allow the shoulders to drop, release the muscles in the arm, remind ourselves that this is not a dangerous situation, we're not 4 years old anymore, we're 24 or 34 or 44 or 54, whatever we are not vulnerable anymore. And then we begin to re-tag these associations. Another form of attention that causes so much suffering is that which fixates on bad news or good news. And we lose track of all the other things that we've got going on. For instance, there's the new relationship bliss. It's so wonderful. It's so great. I finally met her, him. This is the one. And the underlying idea is I'll never have to pay taxes and do the bills. Or I go to work and deal with my family. They're all blurred. And for 2 or 3 months while the dopamine is flowing, the reward circuits in the nucleus accumbens are all fired up. We have no cognition of all the other challenges and, you know, issues in life. On the other hand, when we get bad news, Mrs. or Mr. Wright breaks up with us, says, oh shit, I'm fucked. And we lose track of all the richness of life, the beauty, the spiritual practice we've developed, the support network we have in life, all the skills that we have become evaporated and we become unaware of all the tools and everything we've accomplished becomes, and we become fixated on just this bad news. And so this is why gratitude reflections can be so important, because they reestablish balance. As well as, conversely, opening to discomfort and challenges as well, not avoiding, so that we fully see what's present in life and not get thrown and tossed about every time, you know, there's a downturn in the economy, or our families have a drama, or a relationship meets rocky times. It's fun when we develop this kind of avoidance that comes from being overly fixated on bad news. It in itself creates and fuels addiction. Addiction starts with not being able to sit with discomfort. And it gets fueled by every time there's even the slightest bit of bad news. The addiction flares up and we become fixated then on the avoidance, the diversion, the thing that will remove us. So some people crave alcohol or drugs or sex or food or relationships or gambling or power or whatever. And it's all fueled by the fact that the mind is constantly hyperinflating threats, hyperinflating opportunities, and avoiding physical discomfort. Finally, the last form of tension that I'll talk about that causes suffering is the jumpy attention that doesn't stay put, that can't settle. It could be said in a certain way, culturally, we all have attention deficit disorder to a certain degree. At least that's very much prevalent now. Because there's such a flood of information around us that it's tempting to constantly want to check in. It's virtually everywhere I go now, I see people frantically, you know, engaged in text as if every moment of their life there's something worthy of being shown on social media. Something that's worth being reported on. Look at my lunch! I felt sad! You know. Facebook is like... And so we can't stay put with the subtle. And we can't stay put and watch things as they evolve and change slowly. One of the kinds of attention that causes so much suffering is when we experience something as solid when in fact it's changing. For instance, we may have a fear of depression, and that can be born of two things. I'm going to talk about this in a moment, the way we perceive depression, but also we don't stay long enough with the presentation of any part of depression to see that it's always changing. The moment we feel sad, we're like, ah, I'm depressed, this is horrible, and we don't see, well, this time depression is, the breath of depression is very incomplete in the out-breath, but the in-breath is full, or this time I'm feeling the sluggishness in my chest, not in my belly. Or this time the thoughts are not about how bad the future is going to be. This time the thoughts are all about how I suck right now. These are changes. But if we don't stay around long enough, we don't notice how everything we're experiencing is in flux. Another bad news about having a jumpy form of attention is that in life, if we want to change bad habits, we have to stay long enough focused on the results to really get deeply that something's causing us harm. We may have an addiction to food, and we only stay long enough till we feel the stress. We immediately go grab the vanilla donut, cram it in our face, and eat it, and then we feel the relief, and then we move on to something else, TV, Facebook, whatever. But if we then stayed around long enough and focused, okay, how do I feel now? After I've digested, how do I feel now? Is there still relief? Is there still relief 10 minutes later? Then we begin to see a completely different picture. Oh, this isn't solving anything. This is simply giving me a momentary, short-term relief. If we don't continually check back in and remember to focus our awareness and follow through with our actions, we stay stuck in short-term happiness, not long-term happiness. Things that, for example, are skillful for us in the long term often suck in the short term. I could name a million examples, but, you know, obviously exercise. When you're first doing it, after a while people love it because it releases those endorphins and you begin to realize it. But at first, if you don't stay around long enough, if you just do it, it's uncomfortable and you jump away, you'll never get the endorphin release. You'll never get the feeling of being fully in the body and any positive that it can bring. So just quickly with perception, the way perception causes us suffering is two ways. Primarily, we group under a large label a bunch of different sensations that really shouldn't. So, for example, if you go to a Buddhist therapist and you sit down, I won't say you because you've probably never done this. I'll say person A goes to a therapist and they say, "I'm depressed." And the therapist says, "Oh, really? How does that feel?" And then person A says, "That doesn't feel good. What are you, crazy? I'm depressed." Then the therapist says, "No, specifically, how does depression feel? What do you feel in the body?" "Oh, well, the body feels tired. The body feels sluggish. I just feel exhausted." "Okay, what do you feel in your mind? What is the mind?" "Well, the mind's tired and uninspired. I don't have a lot of thoughts. I'm feeling kind of unfocused." "Okay, what kind of thoughts do you have?" "Oh, well, the thoughts are all negative, the future's bad." If you examine that, we've just encountered three completely separate domains that are lumped under depression. We've got the body, we've got the mind overall, and the moods overall, and then we've got the thoughts. Now, if you try to work on a vague concept like depression or anger, nothing will be accomplished. But if we focus individually on relieving an individual component, then we can make headway. For example, if we've got anger management issues, if we simply say, anger fucks me up, that will accomplish nothing. We will be stuck with it. But if we say, okay, anger is overwhelming to me, I'm going to start with how it feels in the body. We find it, we turn our awareness to it, we detach from the thoughts, we allow anger to arise, to crest, to release, and then we begin slowly over time to create a safe space to contain the anger, a vessel for it in the body. We relax around it so that the energy of anger in the body doesn't consume us all. Then we can be with that energy and it won't push us around, it won't make us shout and take it out on people we love. So again, if we focus on an individual component, we can actually make headway. If we try to tackle these globalized issues, vague issues like anger, depression, sadness, resentment, confusion, that will not solve anything. We've got to go specifically into the components. And then there's misperception. Misperception is when we tag an experience with the first label that comes to mind and we don't see it for what it really is. Humorously, I knew a woman that was a good friend who told me that for years, I've told this story before, but she for years thought what was lust was actually turned out to be fear. She'd meet a guy, every red flag would go up, danger, danger, alert, alert, bad news, bad news. The guy would talk, everything would get tense, and she'd say, "Ooh, I'm really attracted to him." Well, you can guess how that would turn out. And yet it's so easy because so many of the sensations that comprise fear are identical physically to the sensations that alert us to desire. It's only by sitting and truly focusing that we can notice the subtle differences between the two. Another example is very often we might say, I'm bored. I'm bored. This is boring. I don't like this. This is really fucking boring. But then when we look and we really investigate what's going on, we see, in fact, that there's this subtle building of feelings that we don't want to recognize or open to in the body. And so we're looking for diversions, and there's no diversions. And that feeling we call boredom. It's actually, it can be loneliness. It can be lack of awareness of the body. It can be lack of comfort in just being present. But we experience that as boredom. It's not. It's anxiety. So to sum up, the key ways to relay is to systematically remember when we have any challenging or difficult experience, go into the body, see how the breath is, see where the gut feelings and fear emotions are registering in the body. Is the stomach tight? The shoulders tight? Is the jaw locked? The forehead muscles tight? Are the muscles clenched? Open to those feelings. We can ask ourselves, what am I really frightened of here? And just see what's present. And we can reflect on all the skillful things that are available in life rather than getting caught up in the new information and hyperfixating on each new fear or opportunity that's available to us. So I thank you for listening. I hope that there was something tonight that's worth pondering. Now I'm going to turn off the...